You're listening to the Touch 'Em Up podcast. I'm your host, Double M, and on today's episode, we have UFC 283, Teixeira versus Hill, preview predictions and analysis. UFC 283 takes place this upcoming Saturday, January 21st, from the Juness Arena in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. In the main event of the evening, you have a battle for the vacant light heavyweight championship after the main event of UFC 282 between Jan Blachowicz and Magomed Ankalaev ended up being declared a draw, so it left the 205-pound title vacant. And in that fight, you have the former light heavyweight champion in Glover Teixeira going up against the number, I believe, six-ranked light heavyweight in the world in Jamal Sweet Dreams Hill. He's actually ranked number seven. So Teixeira versus Hill, number two versus number seven, for the light heavyweight championship of the world. Can Glover reclaim gold in his home country, or will we have a new reign atop the UFC light heavyweight throne, and will it be sweet dreams for the title aspirations of Glover Teixeira this late in his MMA career? So without any further ado, let's get this started and step into the ring. All right, everybody. Coming back at you with some UFC 283 predictions, breakdowns, and everything in between. Look, at first I didn't really like the card too much. I thought it was kind of, like, it wasn't a bad card by any means, but I don't know. I wasn't too excited for the main event between Teixeira and Hill, but going off the tape study and going back and watching their last few fights and really breaking it down, it is a very interesting matchup. It's a lot more interesting than I think people are giving this fight credit for. And I feel like this main event is kind of what's taking away from the card, so to speak. But it's a really solid fight. And whoever wins this will more than likely either face Jiří Procházka. If it's Glover, it'll be a rematch that was supposed to take place at UFC 282. And if it's Hill, then he'll go up and face Jiří. He'll probably face Magomed first. So I would say that Teixeira is probably going to face Ankalaev first too. So whoever wins this will probably get a crack at Magomed Ankalaev for the light heavyweight title, even though whoever wins this will be the champion. Aside from that, we have some pretty good fights on the card. We have the Bonfim brothers from the Dana White Contender Series. We're only going to be breaking down one of their fights, and it's going to be the one on the early prelims between Ismael Bonfim and Terrence McKinney. I could break down Gabriel Bonfim versus Munir Lazzez, but I think Ismael Bonfim and Terrence McKinney is a better fight to break down stylistically, and I think it's going to be fireworks from start to finish. I think the Lazzez one is going to be good too, but I feel like this one is one that should be broken down more than the other, because as you know, we don't break down every fight on the card when we do these predictions. But I like the fight between Bonfim and Terrence McKinney. I think it's a great fight. You have Warley Alves versus Nicholas Dalby. That's a pretty good and interesting matchup. You've got Shamil Abdurakhimov and Gilton Almeida. We're going to be breaking that one down for you guys as well. And then we're going to go into the full main card. I mean, Johnny Walker versus Paul Craig. It's kind of the battle of the glass cannons, one in terms of grappling, one in terms of the striking. So that's going to be a really interesting fight to break down between top 15 ranked contenders. You got Lauren Murphy and Jessica Andrade, Gilbert Burns and Neil Magny, the quadrilogy bout between Davison Figueiredo and Brandon Moreno to unify the flyweight championship. I mean, there's a lot of really good fights on the card. And I guess we can talk a little bit about last weekend's events at UFC Vegas 67. Overall picks for me were pretty decent. I was worried about that main event. I know I picked Imavov, but I knew that, you know, Strickland was going to be able to push the pace. I didn't think he would win almost every single round, and that's what he did. He won four out of the five, sometimes three out of the five, depending on which judge you're asking. But, I mean, he really came in and showed up, even if it was at 205 pounds. You know, Strickland came in and proved the point. And Imavov, maybe we got to cool off the talks of him being at the top of the division for a little bit. But I still think that Imavov has a bright future at 185. I know this was at 205, but he was facing another middleweight just without the weight cut. So I think Imavov has a bright future. But, you know, we'll have to get there when we get there, because for now, he's going to have to cool off the tracks a little bit. But I'm not going to talk about the card too much. My bets, one of my biggest bets, or at least like my anchors for a lot of my parlays, was the over 2.5 for Barcelos and Nurmagomedov, and obviously that's not what happened. Barcelos coming in, never been knocked out, never been submitted. You know, I didn't think Umar was going to get finished, but I thought if there was going to be a finish, it would be more on the side of Barcelos due to his boxing. And, you know, Umar lands a knee up the middle or feints the knee, lands a left hook, and knocks Barcelos out cold in the first round. So if you had the under in that fight, good on you. If you had Umar by KO, then you're just a genius, because I don't think anybody predicted that. But that fight really just set everything in motion to kind of blow everything up for me. And then the Punahele Soriano and Roman Kapilov. Now, some of those I was okay in terms of some of the parlays because I had the under 2.5. I feel like I should have just played the under 2.5 instead of picking a side for all of the parlays. But on a lot of them, just due to the odds, I think I let the odds get to me. I had Punahele by knockout. And, you know, kind of like what we said, man, the speed of Kapilov was going to be a problem in the body work, especially those kicks to the body. And that's basically how the fight played out. You know, I was worried about it. I feel like I should have stayed away from the fight on any aspect instead, except from playing the unders, which I did in a couple of the parlays, like I said. But, you know, it just didn't happen. And that's the way the cookie crumbles. So I didn't start off 2023 the way that I wanted to. I think I was like minus 1.5 units. I'm going to look to get some good, decent plays for 283, but I'm not going to be going too crazy. Probably just like a unit at the most, maybe a little under a unit of play, because I'm not huge into the gambling. I try to give you guys the best plays for the week, the best plays for the fights, the best plays for the certain aspects. But, you know, I'm probably going to go light on 283, but, you know, let's jump into it. Let's get it started with UFC 283 predictions and breakdown. All right, we're going to start it off in the early prelims or the prelims with the battle in the UFC lightweight division between Ismael Bonfim and Terrence T-Rex McKinney. Bonfim's coming in off the Contender Series win. He's coming into this fight with 18 victories and 3 defeats, going up against Terrence T-Rex McKinney, who's coming in with a record of 13 victories and 4 losses. This is a very interesting fight. This is going to be fireworks for as long as it lasts, whether it ends in the first round, whether it goes all three, whether it ends in the second or the third. For however long this fight lasts, it's going to be fireworks without a doubt. You know, you're in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The Bonfim brothers are from Brazil. You got Gilbert Burns from Brazil. You have Glover Teixeira from Brazil. A lot of Brazilian fighters fighting on home turf. And for some guys, that it's a make or break thing. Like sometimes you come in and you're ready to go, and that motivates you and gets you ready to perform. And sometimes being on home turf and home soil causes an adverse effect, and it makes you have more anxiety, and it affects the performance that you give. I'm sure we're going to have both ends of the spectrum throughout the night, but we're going to start with Bonfim and McKinney. And look, I think that either of these guys are capable of getting a finish. Terrence McKinney is a guy who comes in and it's balls to the wall. It's kill or be killed right from the get-go. I mean, the minute the fight starts, he's coming down the middle. He's getting in your face. He's putting the pressure on, and he's trying to knock you out as quickly as he can. Knock you out, submit you, take you down. That's what McKinney's going to do. He's coming forward. He's a blitzkrieg. He's a buzzsaw. He's a mercenary. His name's T-Rex, like a T-Rex. I mean, he's going to come in and try to rip you apart just like a T-Rex. And he's trying to wreck shop from start to finish. But sometimes he can get a little overconfident. He can blow his wad. He can overcommit. He can throw the kitchen sink at you. And if you can survive, like in the case of Drew Dober, even though that fight was on short notice, then he kind of gasses. You can work the body. You can work up top. And you can find a way to finish him once it gets into that second and the third round. But for the first round, you know, Bonfim's going to have to be careful. He's going to have to mind his P's and Q's, and he's going to have to play on the outside a little bit more. You don't want to rush in on McKinney. You don't want to blitzkrieg him, because if you get into that brawl with McKinney, even though he's not much of a brawler, I feel like that brawling style really goes into the hands of McKinney more than it would be a Bonfim. I feel like if Bonfim wants to win this fight, he has to play just outside of boxing range. He likes to switch a lot to southpaw and land the left kick to the body and the left kick up top to the head. His most powerful kicks are going to be off that southpaw stance switch and landing it with the back left leg. A lot of the times his best boxing work is done in orthodox with the jab, the check left hook, the right hand, the left hooks to the body. He has very, very good body work, and the right calf kicks come from orthodox as well. So a lot of the jabs, the boxing, and the calf kicks or low kicks are going to come from orthodox. but the southpaw is going to be the back kick to the body and the left body, or the straight left to the body, the left switch kick to the body. I mean, everything's good. Not a left switch kick, but the stance switch into the left body kick is going to be what works for Bonfim against McKinney. Both of these guys have good wrestling. I feel like Bonfim is probably a little bit less polished in terms of his wrestling and jiu-jitsu than McKinney is. Even though we don't see it much from McKinney, we've seen he has good top control. He has good pressure, good ability to control the wrist, work from half guard, work from the back side control, get his hooks in. You know, even against Eric Gonzalez, who I believe was his last fight in the UFC, he jumped the back and was able to get the hooks in, but he didn't have both hooks in like around the hips. He had the one hook in and then the other hook came around the backside and locked it up, but it wasn't actually a full set in hook. And he was able to get on the back and lock up that submission and get the tap right up against the cage, hold his position on the back. He's very, very solid in jiu-jitsu. It's just, he likes to come in and strike. He likes to stand and bang. And that's what I feel like we're going to see from McKinney. But if it goes into the second, if it goes into the third, that's where it's going to favor Maheta, Ismael Bonfim. I mean, he's got 18 victories. 12 of the victories come by way of finish, 8 knockouts or TKOs, and 4 by submission, with the other 6 coming by way of decision. Out of his 3 losses, he has only lost via submission. So I feel like he's not going to want to play around on the ground, even though he has good jiu-jitsu and grappling in his own right. I feel like he's going to want to keep this fight at range. He's going to want to keep it at boxing distance more than kicking distance. And he's going to want to work up top to the head with the 1-2s, the left hook. He's going to want to rip the left hook to the body. That's probably his most polished shot, is his left hook to the body. He throws a lot of power in his shots and he kind of overcommits, but I think that's not going to be such a big problem here because Terrence McKinney does the same thing. I don't necessarily think McKinney's the most technical or polished striker. I don't think that he has like unbelievable technical ability. He throws a lot of power shots as well. I think his kicking game is better than Bonfim because he can throw kicks from awkward angles and he's so long and rangy that he can actually throw kicks to the head from like inside the clinch or off the break. He likes that lead right high kick off the break, or if he gets you backed up against the cage, trying to get you to circle onto that lead high kick. He did that against Drew Dober. And we do have to talk about the Dober fight as well. Like, I feel like he went in on short notice. He jumped in, but he dropped Dober twice in that fight. One with a knee right up the middle due to the long length, the reach, the range, you know, in the build of McKinney. And then he dropped him with a right or a left hook, I believe, right up against the cage. It was either a right hook from the lead side or a left hook against the cage. And I thought that Dober was going to be out of there, but he blew his wad. Dober came back and Dober was able to work inside the clinch and work to the body, drop him, and then finish him off all in the first round. So McKinney is going to go 100% from the minute it starts to the minute it ends, whether he's on the winning or the losing side. But when it comes to Bonfim, I feel like he's more technical. He's more measured. He's more cerebral. He can pick you apart a little bit more. Does he throw a lot of power? Yes. Does he have knockout power? Yes. You know, does he wind up and throw big power shots? Yes, he does. But I feel like he can play the more measured, methodical, and tactical game when it comes to the striking on the feet. He can use his angles, use the in and out movement, you know, step off to the rear side, use the check left hook against the southpaw in McKinney, you know, land that back right kick to the body, switch southpaw, land the straight left hand, the right hook behind it, the left shot to the body. He has good power when he squares up his hips as well. Sometimes he'll be in orthodox, land a right hand, switch southpaw, boom, land the straight left down the middle. He actually was able to drop his opponent on the Contender Series doing that by switching his stance, but he didn't stand in a full, like, traditional stance. He kind of squared his hips up, so it was like right hand, boom, hurt him, stepped in, boom, straight left, hurt him, but it was more square, and he wasn't technically in a full-on southpaw stance, but he has power. He has good wrestling and jiu-jitsu, but on that same token, I feel like he's not going to want to play around on the ground and in the grappling, the submission game with McKinney, because I feel like with the long limbs and the reach that McKinney has, I feel like it's more dangerous for Bonfim to play around than for him to entertain the grappling game. Because I think if there is a submission in this fight, it would more come from the side of Terrence McKinney. But when it comes to breaking it down and like making a prediction, I think I'm going to have to go with Ismael Bonfim. I know He's an underdog in this fight. I know it's close on the money line. I think it's like minus 125, plus 110, somewhere around there. But I like Bonfim's technical ability. I like his use of range and distance, his way he gets in and gets out, kind of an in-and-out style. But I love the way he works the body, and I feel like the body work is going to be the kryptonite for Terrence McKinney. And I think he's going to have to survive the early rounds. I think he's going to have to weather the storm. But I think eventually Bonfim starts to find the home for that left hook to the body, works up top with the jab, jab, left hook to the body, 1-2, left hook to the head, left hook to the body. I feel like he mixes things up very well. And that's going to be a problem for McKinney. McKinney does mix it up. He does have variety, but it's all power from the get-go. If he steps back, takes his foot off the gas, and plays more of, you know, a touch and go, even if he takes his foot off the gas and is more patient, I still feel like Bonfim is better technically, and I feel like he has more speed. Now, power-wise, I would probably have to give it to McKinney, but even on power, I feel like it's kind of neck and neck. But I'm going to side with the body work of Bonfim, especially the left hook to the body, the switch kick from switching to southpaw, his ability to land power in stance in orthodox or southpaw, or you know, if he squares up his stance like we already talked about. I think this is a really, really good fight for Bonfim. I think a lot of people are going to come in here and side with McKinney because of the success he's had in the UFC. But McKinney is 12-4, and he's been knocked out or TKO'd before. I feel like Bonfim finds that left hook to the body early. He works it. He hurts him to the body, comes up top to the head, jumps on him for a barrage, and gets the TKO. So my pick is going to be Ismael Magenta Bonfim to defeat Terrence T-Rex McKinney via second round TKO. I think the body work pays off. He works up top to the head and the ref jumps in. All right, up next, we're going to break down a battle in the UFC's heavyweight division between MMA veteran and UFC veteran in Shamil Abdurakhimov, who comes into the bout with a record of 20 victories and 7 defeats, going up against Gilton Almeida, who comes back with a phenomenal record of 17 victories and 2 defeats. Listen, this breakdown isn't going to be the longest, the most intricate breakdown of the fight. Abdurakhimov is good. His record, I feel like, is a little bit deceiving in a negative way. He has a 20-7 record. Is it that bad? No, it's not. But whenever he goes up against high-level opposition or opposition where, you know, we feel like it's going to be a close and competitive fight, and the longer the fight goes, it turns out that that's not what it is. He really seems to get finished. And it's not like he just loses. He gets finished. Now, is he losing to quality opposition? Yes, he is. But he's still losing. I mean, out of his 7 losses, 5 come by way of knockout, 1 by submission and 1 by decision. Out of his 20 victories, he's got 9 KO, TKOs, 4 submissions and 7 decisions. But if you look into the record, he's coming off of 3 back-to-back-to-back knockout losses and 2 in the second round and 1 in the first round. He's got a TKO to Curtis Blaydes, which obviously that's not a bad opposition to lose to in the second round. He's got a second round TKO to Chris Daukaus where he got dropped at the end of the first round with a beautiful picture-perfect left hook. And then he landed a beautiful right-handed Daukaus in the second round and the ref jumped in. And then in the most recent bout, Sergey Pavlovich came in and put him to sleep early. Now, I think that this is what this is. Abdurakhimov is a litmus test to see how good Gilton Almeida can do at the top level of the heavyweight division. Because you look at who he's lost to in terms of Abdurakhimov. Sergey Pavlovich, probably on the brink of a title shot, just knocked out Tai Tuivasa. Chris Daukaus, yeah, he was on his way up. He got knocked out by got knocked out by Curtis Blaydes. Just recently got knocked out by Jairzinho Rozenstrike. He's really just kind of fallen off as Daukaus, and that sucks because I was a big fan of both Daukaus brothers, especially Chris Daukaus at heavyweight. And then to Curtis Blaydes, he lost with the TKO, elbows and punches. The wrestling was too much for him. Before that, he had a TKO in the second round over Marcin Tybura, a unanimous decision over Andrei Arlovsky, you know, a KO in the first round over Chase Sherman. Before that, he lost via TKO in the fourth round to Derek Lewis. So he actually made it to the fourth round with the Black Beast. But as we've seen, you know, the Black Beast as of late, when he gets to the top level of the heavyweight division, he does do good in certain aspects, but he seems to fall apart. So, you know, I'm surprised that Derek Lewis couldn't get him out of there early or that Abdurakhimov didn't get him out of there early. He had a split decision win over Walt Harris, a unanimous decision over Anthony Hamilton. That was back in February of 2016. But Shamil Abdurakhimov is good. He's pretty technical. He has decent movement for a heavyweight, good speed. He doesn't overthrow a lot of his punches. I feel like technically striking, his technical striking, I should say, is pretty polished and really good. He likes to attack the inside low kick. But I think that inside low kick is going to be a big weapon, or be his demise, I should say, against Gilton Almeida. Now let's look over at Almeida. I just got to wait for this to load for me because for some reason I got to find a new website to use. But Gilton Mulhadino. Yeah. Gilton Mulhadino Almeida, 17-2, 17 wins by way of finish. He's never been to the decision. Out of all 17 wins, 11 by submission, 6 by KO, TKO. He's lost twice, one by KO, TKO, and one by decision. His last loss comes all the way back in January of 2018 to Bruno Assis by unanimous decision. And then before that, it was August 2017 via knockout in the first round over Thiago Moreira. That was back at Katana Fight. And since then, at least in the UFC, we'll look at the Contender Series. He fought Nasruddin Nasruddinov. He got a rear naked choke submission in the second round. Goes in, fights Danilo Marquez, gets a first round TKO. Fights Parker Porter, first round rear naked choke. Fights Anton Turkay, first round rear naked choke submission. You know, he's coming in here and he's submitting all of these guys. And he originally fought at light heavyweight. Now he's up at heavyweight. The guy is built like a brick shit house. Like Gilton Almeida is exactly how you want to be built in terms of, you know, a frame for this division. He's long. He's rangy. He's very muscular. He's fast. His striking is fast. His takedown attempts, his entrance on doubles and single legs is fast. His ability to work from the body lock and take you down is fast. Good work from the half guard. Good work from the top position. I mean, if this guy gets on top of you, if this guy gets on top of Abdurakhimov, it's only a matter of time before he either gets TKO'd or submitted. And that's why I think Abdurakhimov is more of a litmus test in regards to this overall contest for Almeida. If he gets past Abdurakhimov, he's right up there in the top 8, top 10, top 5 of the heavyweight division. And the heavyweight division isn't as stacked, but it's probably the most stacked that it's ever been. Like, it's not the most stacked in terms of other divisions, but right now it's probably the most stacked in terms of talent that we've had. And we just gotten the John Jones versus Cyril Gane fight announced for UFC 285, which I'll probably touch on a different podcast because I don't want to take away from these predictions. But when it comes to Almeida versus Abdurakhimov, listen, I think Abdurakhimov's going to stay out there. He's going to try to land his jab. He's going to try to land his inside low kick. The first inside low kick that he throws, Almeida's going to close the distance, take him down, get in the half guard, tie up his wrist with the Dagestani handcuff, break his base, break his posture. Abdurakhimov's going to give up his back. Almeida's going to get his hooks in, flatten him out, land some good punches, land some good ground and pound. Abdurakhimov's going to give up his neck, and Almeida's going to get the rear naked choke. I think Almeida finishes him in the first round. It could be a TKO. I could see him getting the mount. I could see Abdurakhimov turning his back, or turning back to his back, giving up the mount and getting TKO'd. I could see him giving up his back and getting TKO'd that way. I could see Almeida flattening him out and getting a rear naked choke. But I'm going to side with the submission. I think that Almeida is going to catch one of those kicks or enter in on a double leg on one of those low kicks of Abdurakhimov. He's going to lock his hands, take him down. Abdurakhimov's immediately going to try to give up his back and stand up. Almeida's going to get his hooks in, flatten him out, land some ground and pound, almost get the TKO, but then Abdurakhimov's going to give up his neck, and we're going to get the first round rear naked choke submission for Gilton Almeida. So my pick is Gilton Mulhadino Almeida to defeat Shamil Abdurakhimov via first round rear naked choke submission. If you go and look at the overall rankings of this matchup, I believe Abdurakhimov's in the top 15. Yeah, so Abdurakhimov's number 15 in the division. This is going to break Almeida into the top 15, and then he'll probably get a top 10. If he beats a top 10, he'll probably get a top 5. Like I said, heavyweight is more stacked than it's ever been, but compared to other divisions, it's not the most stacked division in the UFC. So I'm going to go with Almeida. I think he rolls here. I think he continues the undefeated streak. I think he has a lot of success up at heavyweight. And I mean, you look at the line, he's a minus 900 favorite compared to a plus 625 for Abdurakhimov. I know people are going to say, oh, Abdurakhimov's good value. No, he's not. He's absolutely not. The only way to play this fight is the under 1.5 or Gelton Almeida by submission, or you could probably get the double method chance of victory on DraftKings and do Almeida by submission or TKO. Either way, Almeida's going to finish Abdurakhimov. He's going to do it quick. He's going to do it flawless. He's going to make it look easy, and Almeida's going to roll into the top 10 of the heavyweight division, or at least get a top 10 opposition next. So takedown off the kick. Take the back, flatten out, ground and pound, rear naked choke. First round rear naked choke submission for Gelton Almeida. All right, up next we move to the main card in a banger of an opener. A very fun fight to open up the main card. In the light heavyweight division between top 15 ranked opposition, you have the number 9 ranked Paul Berju Craig, who comes in with a record of 16 victories, 5 defeats, and 1 no contest. Going up against the number 12 ranked Johnny Walker, who comes back with a record of 19 victories and 7 defeats. Listen, we know how this fight's going to play out. If Paul Craig's going to win this fight, it's going to be by submission. Whether it's him getting a takedown, whether it's him, you know, getting into a clinch position and pulling Johnny Walker into his guard, trying to lock that Americana-style shoulder lock on one of the arms like he did against Jamal Hill and look to lock up a submission. That's how Paul Craig's going to win. But the difference between Paul Craig and other jiu-jitsu artists is this man can be on the brink of defeat in any aspect and find a way to lock up a submission and win the fight. If Paul Craig could be encompassed in one fight, it would literally be Anderson Silva versus Chael Sonnen 1 at UFC 117. Because Paul Craig gets his ass kicked in the entire fight, his striking isn't that great. It's decent. I feel like his striking has gotten better, but he's losing until he finds a submission and he wins. Like that's exactly what and if I'm going to compare that to one fight in MMA, it's Chael Sonnen versus Anderson Silva 1. Chael Sonnen versus Anderson Silva 1, where Sonnen's just beating the tar out of him for 4 3/4 of a round, and then he locks up a triangle choke, submits him, and retains the title. That's Paul Craig in MMA terms. He is losing the fight until he locks up the submission, and he wins. If you don't believe me, if you're not, like, super well-versed in MMA, I will give you an example, and I will break down his record. Maybe if this thing would load and not be so freaking slow all the time. I swear, I don't know what's wrong with this website because I use SureDog all the time. And for some reason, it just, like, lately has not wanted to work, like, at all. So let me see. Let's go to the Paul Craig. 16-5-1. Out of his 16 victories. Come on. Sorry for the lack of time that this takes, the lack of speed. 13 out of his 16 victories come by way of submission, 3 by KO, TKO, and none by decision. So out of all 16 victories, he's a finisher, but 13 out of 16 by submission. Out of his 5 losses, he's been KO'd or TKO'd 3 times, lost 1 fight by submission and 1 by decision. You look at his last few fights, you know, he was on a 5-fight win streak going into the Volkan Uzdemir fight. He lost that fight via unanimous decision. 5 wins and 1 draw going into that fight. He beat Vinicius Moreira via rear naked choke in the first round. He beat Gadzi Murav Antigulov via triangle choke in the first round. He beat Mauricio Shogun Hua submission to punches in the second round. Jamal Hill in the first round via TKO, but it was really due to a submission because he basically broke his arm with that armbar position that Jamal Hill gave up to him. And then he locked him in a triangle and was punching him until the ref stopped it, but his arm was already broken. And then he won via triangle choke at the end of the first round, 3:57 in, after Krylov played in his guard and was beating the shit out of him. I mean, just landing big, heavy punches. Craig was trying to roll with it, but he was clearly losing the round. And then he jumps, you know, Nikita Krylov leaves his arm on his chest for a little bit too long inside the guard of Craig. Craig locks up the triangle choke, turns the corner, cuts off any air, and boom, that's it. Like, the minute this guy locks up a submission, the fight's over. And that's the case for any light heavyweight. That's what I don't think people understand. You know, Paul Craig is like a Kaol Uno. He's like a BJ, well, not a BJ Penn, but who's a guy who really his only way to win was like via submission. I mean, there's a lot you could probably think of. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but that's the only way that this guy's going to win. He's like a new age Hoist Gracie, you know? Like that, I'm not comparing Paul Craig to Hoist Gracie in terms of accolades or anything, but that's basically his attempt. It's submission or bust. Now, going up against his opponent in Johnny Walker, Walker has really just fallen off. He had a fall from grace. I mean, going into that fight against Corey Anderson at UFC 230, I believe it was UFC 230. It might have been UFC 217. We're going to find out soon. 19-7, right? Kind of like Shamil Abdurakhimov. It doesn't look like that bad. It's not that bad of a record, you know, et cetera, et cetera. 15 wins by KO, TKO, 3 by submission, 1 decision out of his 7 losses. 4 losses come by way of KO, TKO, 1 by submission, and 2 by decision. But if you look at his recent fights, I mean, he's 2-4 in his last 6 outings. He lost at UFC 244, not 230, to Corey Anderson via TKO in the first round. Corey Anderson was a setup fight for Johnny Walker. That was the UFC's way to get Johnny Walker to fight John Jones for the light heavyweight title. It didn't work out. Anderson boxed him up, dropped him all over the place, and exposed him. He goes in and fights Nikita Krylov, gets out-grappled for the entirety of the fight, and loses a unanimous decision. He comes in, fights Ryan Spann. Questionable win, questionable stoppage, landing, you know, shots to the back of the head, elbows, et cetera, et cetera. But he gets the TKO in the first round. And, you know, everybody thinks Johnny Walker's back. He goes and fights Thiago Santos. They go 5 rounds. And yes, it was a close fight, but it was boring. They barely did anything. Johnny Walker was you know, gun shy. Thiago Santos was coming back from the injury, I believe. Or that might have been after the loss to Glover Teixeira. And, you know, he was gun-shy as well. The fight went all 5 rounds. It was very boring. He lost the unanimous decision. Comes in, fights Jamahal Hill, gets knocked out in the first round. Then he just recently gets back on track at UFC 279 and beats Iwan Kutelaba via first round's rear naked choke submission. Now, Johnny Walker is not a submission guy. I mean, I know it says he has 3 submissions on his record, but before that win, most recently against Iwan Kutelaba, the last submission that Johnny Walker has came all the way back in 2017. So it's been almost 3 years since Johnny, or almost 7 years. No, wait. Almost 7 years since Johnny Walker has gotten a submission in his MMA career. And he's not going to submit Paul Craig. I mean, that's just not going to happen. It's either going to be Johnny Walker uses that inside, in and out, you know, lackadaisical footwork and movement, cuts angles, lands good high kicks, and lands a big shot and knocks out Paul Craig. Or Paul Craig is going to find a way to get into a grappling exchange. Maybe he blocks a punch of Johnny Walker, pulls guard, jumps guard, you know, rolls for the Ashigarami game on the leg lock, takes the back, finds a way to get the top position, works the rear naked choke, works the triangle, something like that, you know, and he's going to submit Johnny Walker. Now, do I think Johnny Walker can hang around with Paul Craig on the floor? No, absolutely not. Do I think Paul Craig can hang around with Johnny Walker on the feet? No, absolutely not. But I don't think Johnny Walker is going to play around too much in terms of the jiu-jitsu and submission game of a Paul Craig. You know, I think that he knows himself well enough at this point in his career, after all those losses, even though he's a wild man, I think he's going to know that he has to keep this fight at a very specific range, and he's not going to play around with, you know, Paul Craig on the floor. And you looked at the fight, if you look at the fight, I should say, with Volkan Oezdemir, which was Paul Craig's last fight, he had some good success on the feet, landed some good high kicks, like he looked okay. He tied him up in some good positions and almost had him at certain points, especially with the leg locks, I believe, if I remember correctly. And, you know, but for the most part, Oezdemir was able to stay on his feet, back away, and keep it at a distance. I don't necessarily think this fight is going to be as exciting as people expect, because I think Walker is going to take the smart approach. I really don't even want to make a pick here. I know that Paul Craig is the more consistent fighter, and he's been more consistent in his career. And I know Walker, yeah, he submitted Kutelaba, but before that, he was really hot and cold in his MMA career, especially in the UFC, you know, getting knocked out, losing decisions. You know, his chin is basically gone. I don't think Paul Craig's going to be a guy who's going to knock out Johnny Walker. I think Johnny Walker is more than capable of knocking out a Paul Craig. But to be honest, this fight is very hard to pick. I feel like this is 50-50. It's either Paul Craig by submission or Johnny Walker by knockout. There's no in between. I think we get a finish in this fight either way. If you're going to play the fight, I think the best way to play the fight is fight doesn't go the distance. If you're on the Craig side, like I said, you play Paul Craig by submission. If you're on the Walker side, you play Johnny Walker by KO, TKO. I think Walker's going to be smart enough to not play around on the floor with Paul Craig. And I think he's going to eventually find a big shot on the feet, drop Paul Craig, hurt him, and get him out of there. I don't even feel comfortable making this pick for Johnny Walker, like I said, but I just feel like he's going to be too smart to play in the game of Paul Craig. We've said that with other opponents, and it hasn't gone their way, but I think he's going to take a lot of information from that Volkan Uzdemir fight. I think he's a lot longer. I don't think he has more power than Volkan, but I think he has more speed and range, which is going to add to the power that he possesses in his shots. I think he catches Paul Craig on the chin and gets him out of there in round one. So I'm going to go with the number 12 ranked Johnny Walker to defeat the number 9 ranked Paul Bearjew Craig via first round TKO. Like I said, KO or submission. KO for Walker, submission for Paul Craig. But I'm going to go with Johnny Walker. I think that Volkan Uzdemir fight really is going to give Johnny the blueprint, and he's so much longer, taller, and rangier. You know, he has a great frame for light heavyweight. I think he gets back on track with his second win in a row and knocks out Paul Craig in this fight. So I'm going to go with Johnny Walker to defeat Paul Craig via first round KO TKO. All right, up next is a battle in the women's flyweight division between top 7 ranked contenders, top 10 ranked contenders. In the number 4 ranked, Lauren Murphy, who comes into the fight with a record of 16 victories and 5 defeats, going up against the number 6 ranked former strawweight champion, former flyweight title challenger, in Jessica Bate Estaca Andrade, who comes in with a record of 23 victories and 9 defeats. I'm going to be honest, this is an interesting one. You know, I think a lot of people are going to immediately see Andrade and just pick her right off the bat and be like, oh, she's going to knock out Lauren Murphy. You know, this and that. And I completely understand where you're coming from, and I might make that same pick as well, but I'm going to give you a little bit more information before I give you my pick for the fight. You know, Andrade fought the better competition, but Murphy's not a slouch, man. I think, like, people are discrediting Murphy's ability to fight, her fighting style and stuff like that. I think he can give Andrade some trouble. She's 16-5 overall is lucky Lauren Murphy. And, you know, out of those 16 victories, she has 7 wins by decision, 8 by KO, TKO, 1 by submission. Out of her 5 losses, she's only been TKO'd one time, and that was against the flyweight champion in Valentina the Bullet Shevchenko, who also TKO'd her opponent in this fight, in Jessica Andrade. Other than that, her losses come by way of decision. She's very durable. Going into Lauren Murphy's last fight, she won a unanimous decision over Misha Tate back in July of 2022. Prior to that, it was a 4th-round TKO to Valentina Shevchenko, but she made it to the 4th round. She lasted longer than Andrade did against Valentina. Then you look at her fight before that. She won a split decision over Joanne Calderwood. Before that, a rear-naked choke in the 2nd round over Lilia Shakirova. Before that, it was a unanimous decision over Roxanne Modafferi. A split decision win over Andrea Lee. A TKO over Mara Romero Barella in the 3rd round, which isn't the greatest win. I mean, Mara Romero Barella is kind of I mean, I don't know. She lost to Shajara Eubanks, which doesn't look the greatest. I mean, considering Eubanks' record, I believe, is 7-7 or something like that. Isn't it 7-7? Let me see. 7-7. I was right. She lost via unanimous decision back in June of 2018. Before that, split decision win over Barb Honchak. You know, for the most part, Lauren Murphy is going to make a lot of these fights close. And I know her name's Lucky, but sometimes she gets lucky on the decisions. She looked good against Misha Tate, but again, it was a close fight. She got dominated by Valentina Shevchenko, but she hung in there. She stuck it out till the 4th round until she couldn't hang in there anymore. Murphy doesn't do anything extremely technical. She doesn't do anything super well. A lot of jabs, a lot of double jab right hand, a lot of movement. She's very, you know, elusive on the feet, but not in a good way. She's very herky-jerky is the best way to put it. You know, moving in and out, moving left and right, landing a couple shots, trying to jab-jab, inside low kick, jab-jab, outside low kick, jab, right hand, left hook, slip, roll, move, you know, bomb, push you up against the cage, make it a dirty fight. And the only way that Murphy is going to beat Andrade is to make it a dirty, nasty fight. She has to get in her face, push her up against the cage, knees in the clinch, elbows over the top, you know, break her down, knees to the body, stomp on her toes, elbows over the top in the clinch, you know, to try to toss her around, get into close range. Because if you stay far enough away at a distance, it's only going to be a matter of time before Andrade cuts you off, slips to the outside, comes back with a left hook, slips inside, comes over the top with the right hand, slips inside, works the left hook to the body, and she's going to eventually slow you down, cut you off, and bombard you and land a barrage up against the cage. And it's no different here. I mean, you look at Jessica Andrade in terms of her flyweight division record. The only person she's lost to at flyweight is the champion in Valentina Shevchenko. Now, you know, Lauren Murphy lasted longer than Andrade did against Valentina Shevchenko. Andrade got finished in the second round via TKO inside the crucifix, came back with a first round TKO over Cynthia Calvillo, and then a standing arm triangle choke submission, the only standing arm triangle choke submission in the UFC, over Amanda Lemos back at strawweight. That was in round one at 3 minutes and 13 seconds. And that's a good win. That's a really good win for Andrade. I picked Lemos over Andrade in that fight, and she shut her down early, but she was having some trouble with the speed and the technical ability of Lemos. But even winning that, I mean, Lemos just defeated Marina Rodriguez. I think it was via fourth round TKO, a standing TKO. The ref jumped in, stopped the fight. I picked Marina Rodriguez to defeat Lemos there. But, you know, before that loss to Shevchenko, I mean, she KO'd Caitlin Chookagian with shots to the body. So she's 2-1 at 125 pounds, only loss coming to Shevchenko. Her two wins over Calvillo and Chookagian come via KO, TKO. And then the finish over Amanda Lemos was at 115 pounds. That was via standing arm triangle choke in the first round. Look, I don't really see a way that Murphy wins this fight. I could see you saying, oh, she's going to outpace her. She's going to outwork her. She's going to outvolume her over 15 minutes. I know that she's durable. I know that she's, you know, a very tough girl is Lauren Murphy. And the only time she got finished, at least recently, was the TKO loss to Valentina Shevchenko. And she lasted longer than Andrade did. So based on MMA math, you would think that Andrade wouldn't be able to finish her. I think Andrade can definitely finish her. I think Andrade is going to work the body. I think it's going to be tough early on, but eventually Andrade is going to close that distance, crash the pocket, push Murphy up against the cage, and start to work her body shots, start to work the hooks up top to the head, the overhands, the uppercuts. I do see a world where Murphy kind of outpoints her, pushes her up against the cage, makes it dirty, and maybe tires her out and steals the second and third round, you know, and wins the fight that way. But I don't think she's going to be able to stay safe for 15 minutes against Andrade. I know she's durable. I know she never gets finished. But I think if anybody can finish her aside from Shevchenko, it's Jessica Andrade. And like I said, I know you're going to say that, you know, well, Murphy lasted longer than Andrade did against Shevchenko. Yeah, and you would be correct, and I could see your point there. But I think the speed and power of Andrade is going to be too much. I think she's going to work the body, work the left hook up top to the head. She has very good slips with her head movement. She rolls too, kind of like a bob and weave, but her slipping and countering is very good. Slipping outside the jab, coming back with the right hand, slipping inside, left hook to the body, left hook up top to the head, slip inside, jab, slip inside, boom, 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 throw some combinations. You know, Andrade is very good with her head movement. And I think that's going to be a problem for Murphy. I think it's going to be awkward for Murphy to try to get, you know, into the range that she needs to be at. And even if she gets in the clinch against Andrade, I know Murphy's very strong. She's durable. She's tough. She makes the fights dirty. But, I mean, I don't think she's nearly as strong as Andrade. And I think Andrade is going to be able to outpower her in the clinch, whether it's the double unders, whether it's the over-under clinch positions. I think she's going to be able to overpower her. I think she's going to be able to take her down if she needs to. But to be honest, I think it's just going to be a matter of time before Andrade finds a shot that hurts Murphy, and she's going to put her out. I think she's going to take her out. I think she continues the finishing streak. Andrade is such a heavy favorite on the money line. I think she's like minus 500, minus 450, somewhere around there. Yeah, minus 450 to plus 360 for lucky Lauren Murphy. I mean, that's exactly what Murphy has to be in this fight, is lucky. Maybe she gets a lucky decision, makes it close. But I don't think she lasts all 15. And I think eventually just the stalking pressure. You know, Andrade is kind of like a Michael Myers. She's going to stalk you. She's going to walk you down. You're going to try to get her off of you. Murphy's going to try to land some combinations, try to push her off, try to work in the clinch. And I just think no matter what Murphy does, she's not going to be able to get the job done here. I could see a world where maybe Murphy's stronger than Andrade thinks inside the clinch, and she ties her up, pushes her against the cage, and keeps her there for a majority of the fight and wins. But anytime they're at striking range, Andrade is going to beat Lauren Murphy. And I think it's like I said, she's going to walk her down. She's going to stalk her like the Michael Myers of the strawweight division, or the flyweight division. I'm sorry. She's going to find some good shots. She's going to land up top to the head, work the body. I think the body shots are going to be the best weapon for Andrade because it's not going to be easy to finish Murphy to the head, but I think she's vulnerable to the body, just like Caitlin Chookagian was, and, you know, kind of like Cynthia Calvillo was, but Calvillo got hurt more to the head. She's going to stalk her. She's going to work the body, left hook to the body, right hook to the body, left hook up top to the head, right hook to the head, jab, left hook, slip, left hook to the body, left hook up top, right hand. And she's going to eventually just walk her down, push her up against the cage, and finish her. I think it's going to be similar to the Cynthia Calvillo finish, but I think Murphy's going to last a little bit longer. But she's going to go into that second round and get stopped by Andrade. So my pick is the number 6 ranked flyweight in Jessica Bate Estaca Andrade to defeat the number 4 ranked Lucky Lauren Murphy via second round TKO. Stalk her, walk her down, be the Michael Myers of the strawweight division, work the body, work up top to the head, and eventually get her out of there. Maybe if you want to be, you know, if you're chasing the odds, you play Andrade by decision because of how durable Murphy is. But like I said, I know Shevchenko's the only one to get her out of there, but if anybody else can do it, it's Jessica Andrade. So I'm going to go with her getting another finish at flyweight and getting her out of there in the second round via TKO. All right, and now we get to the featured bout of the evening in the UFC's welterweight division. You have a hometown hero, so to speak, in the number 5 ranked Gilbert Dorino Burns, who comes into this fight with a record of, I believe, 20-6, right? 20-5. I was off by one. 20-5. He's ranked number 5 in the welterweight division. Former title challenger at welterweight. Recently has wins over the likes of Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. Lost his most recent fight to Khamzat Chimaev, but it was a back-and-forth war. Some people thought Burns did enough to win that fight. He hurt Chimaev. He dropped Chimaev. Chimaev dropped him, but it was a back-and-forth battle. And he's going up against the number 12-ranked streaking contender in Neil the Haitian Sensation Magny, who comes back with a record of 27 victories and 10 defeats. This is a great fight. It's very interesting. You know, I know a lot of people, it's kind of like, I feel like this is a good narrative, or this is the narrative for a lot of fights on this card, is that one person is just going to bum rush and berserk the other fighter. And I feel like a lot of people aren't giving Neil Magny the credit that he deserves for how well-rounded of a fighter he is. And not only that, but how much his range and distance management, especially behind his jab and orthodox, can give problems to a guy like Gilbert Burns. 27-10, 20-5. Burns coming off the loss via decision to Chimaev. And then Neil Magny is coming off of that third round submission victory over Daniel D-Rod Rodriguez in a fight where I picked against him. I thought for sure Magny was going to have some success, but I did not think he was going to get the job done at all. And not only did he beat Daniel Rodriguez, but he finished him, showcasing his grappling, his wrestling, his ability to use top control and pressure, and eventually locked up that Darce choke standing and brought him down to the ground and submitted him. But his wrestling, his takedowns in that fight, his top control, you know, he really showcased how good his wrestling can be. And when it comes to Neil Magny, that's something we don't really see much from him. A lot of the times it's using his length, using his reach, using the gifts that God gave him by being able to keep opponents at a distance and use that crisp jab, double the jab, triple the jab, pop the 1-2. Magny's always been a volume guy. He's not a really heavy power striker. He doesn't have a lot of power. If he finishes you or if he hurts you, it's due to his volume. But Magny has good wins. I mean, the submission victory over Daniel Rodriguez. He's got a decision win over Jeff Hands of Steel Neal, who just finished Vicente Luque. You know, he doesn't lose very often. His last loss came via second round submission to Shavkat Rakhmonov. He got submitted with a guillotine choke, got out wrestled, got out grappled, got controlled for the entirety of the fight. I think he landed a few shots early on, but other than that, it was the Rakhmonov show, and now Rakhmonov's going to go up against Jeff Neal at UFC 285. Yeah, look, Gilbert Burns is definitely the more well-rounded fighter. Gilbert Burns definitely has the bigger power. He's definitely the more capable grappler. He's got much better wrestling and jiu-jitsu. He's basically better everywhere, but the thing that's going to give him problems is the jab of Neil Magny, the straight right hand of Neil Magny, and the ability to use his reach and distance to keep Burns at the end of his strikes. And that's going to give Gilbert Burns trouble. I'm sorry. I know people think that Burns is going to come in here and absolutely obliterate Neil Magny. Could I see it happening? Yes, I could. But as long as this fight stays at striking range, if Magny can keep Burns behind the jab, if he can pop those right hands behind it, double up the jab, triple up the jab, land the 1-2, land the hook behind the cross, and really just get the volume on Gilbert Burns, I think that he's going to have a lot of success in this fight and a lot more success than people are giving Magny credit for. It's going to be hard for Burns to really beat a guy like Magny on the feet unless he slips those big jabs, comes over the top with the right hand, you know, slips the right hand and is able to counter with the left hook. Their overhand right and the left hook are going to be the best weapons for Gilbert Burns on the feet. When it comes to Magny, the best weapons for him are volume, punches and bunches, and using the jab to dictate the range and pace that the fight is fought at. We've seen Burns have trouble with jabs in the past. He got dropped with a jab from southpaw 2 times, once against the former champion in Kamaru Usman. He was getting pieced up with the jab from Orthodox all night, but the southpaw jab is what eventually dropped him and led to the finish. And then against Khamzat Chimaev, the only time he got dropped in that fight was when Chimaev switched to southpaw and popped him with a southpaw jab. I think we're going to see Magny use the southpaw stance a lot. I think we may see him switch stances back and forth and try to exploit that weakness that Burns has for the jab, but more importantly, the jab from the southpaw stance. I actually did a breakdown on Burns' lack of defense and trouble with the southpaw jab. If you check out my YouTube channel, which is the same name as the podcast, or check out my TikTok, which is at Touch 'Em Up Podcast, you can see how I broke it down and how, you know, he really has trouble with the jab, especially when it comes from southpaw. I think he's so used to fighting orthodox fighters and being able to slip inside the jab and come over the top with the overhand right, or slip outside the jab and be able to come through with a left hook like he did against Damian Maia, which led to the drop in the finish for him, which put him on this collision course to the welterweight title. But Burns really is a well-rounded guy. And for having some trouble at 155 and being a guy that got knocked out by Dan Hooker at 155, you know, he fought Mike Davis down at 155 pounds, who I actually did a video interview with. If you go and check that out on my YouTube channel, I believe he beat Mike Davis via decision. I could be wrong there, but I'm pretty sure it was a decision. But, you know, this is a tough fight for it's a tough fight for Burns on the feet, a lot tougher than people are thinking, but it's going to be a very, very rough night for Magny if Burns uses his wrestling and his takedowns. And I honestly think that's what we're going to see here. I could see Magny getting caught on the feet and getting hurt and knocked out, but Magny's not really a guy who gets finished. I believe the only guy to ever knock out Neil Magny was Santiago Ponzinibbio back in like 2015 or 2016. He landed a jab to the body and came over the top with the right hand and knocked out Neil Magny as Magny was back to the fence and he face planted. That was actually the last fight that Ponzinibbio had before he went on that injury hiatus due to the staph infection and some other things. If you want to learn a little bit about Ponzinibbio's trials and tribulations and why he had to step away from MMA for so long, actually go and check out the first interview I did on this podcast with Haider Hassan from The Ultimate Fighter, who was a teammate of Ponzinibbio at American Top Team, and you can learn a little bit more. I'll probably put a link to that in the description if you're interested, and I'll also link the interview with Mike Davis. But I think Gilbert Burns is going to use his wrestling here. I think he's going to close the distance, use the jab, use the left hook, use his overhand right whenever Magny tries to throw that jab. I think we're going to see him kind of step in and out of range, really take the pace and pressure, take the foot off the gas early, try to get Magny to overcommit on the jab, pop him with the left hook if he's slipping to the outside, or slip inside the jab and come over the top with the big overhand right, which we've seen Burns knock people out with before. We saw him hurt the former champion in Usman with the overhand right. We saw him drop Damian Maia with the left hook. The overhand right and the left hook are going to be the biggest weapons for Burns on the feet. The jab, the volume, striking, the 1-2s from Magny, the straight punches and the volume, that's going to be his best weapon on the feet. But if Burns really wants to make a case and really go out of his way to make a statement in this fight, I expect him to entertain the striking for maybe the first 2 minutes of the fight and then eventually look to work in the takedowns and the wrestling, the top control, and look to set up a submission against Neil Magny. We've seen him have trouble with guys in the past who have really good wrestling, really good jiu-jitsu. I mean, Shavkat Rakhmonov, Rafael Dos Anjos, both those guys have submitted Neil Magny. You know, and I think his wrestling has gotten better from an offensive perspective, and I think he's good at defending inside the clinch because of his height and his reach. I think it's going to be a little bit harder for Burns to take him down from inside the clinch, but double legs and single legs I think are going to work very well for Burns, and he's a black belt world champion in jiu-jitsu. I think eventually he's going to get the top position, look to land some ground and pound and lock up a rear naked choke submission. I could see him getting a guillotine. I could see him getting an arm triangle, but I'm going to go with the rear naked choke. I think Magny gives up his back to try to stand up. Burns grabs the neck and chokes him out. So my pick is going to be Gilbert Durinho Burns to defeat Neil, the Haitian sensation Magny, via a second round rear naked choke submission. I know a lot of people are expecting this fight to go the distance. I feel like I've heard that a lot this week, that a lot of people are expecting Magny to be durable enough to resist the finishing upside from Durinho and Gilbert Burns. But I think the jiu-jitsu and the wrestling is really going to showcase the inefficiencies in Magny's grappling, wrestling, and jiu-jitsu game. And I just think we've seen it in the past so many times with Magny when he has heavy wrestlers, heavy grapplers, heavy jiu-jitsu artists. He really has a lot of trouble with them. And, you know, like I said, RDA submitted him with an arm triangle. Shavkat Rakhmonov in his most recent fight before the win over Daniel Rodriguez submitted him with an arm and guillotine, but he was out grappling him for the entirety of the fight. And although we've seen good wrestling from Magny on his side in terms of offensive and decent takedown defense at certain points, I just think that Gilbert Burns is going to slice through him like butter when it hits the mat. And I think that's Gilbert Burns knows that, and that's where he's going to look to entertain his victory, or that's where he's going to look to exploit the path of least resistance to get the victory in his hometown of Brazil, or home country of Brazil. So I think he's going to take him down. I think early the striking will be a little bit competitive. I do think the jab of Magny's going to work early, but I think later on in that first round, going into the second round, Magny's going to get taken down. Burns is going to exploit that, take the mount, land some good shots. Magny's going to give up his back, and Burns is going to submit him with a rear naked choke. So my pick is going to be the number 5 ranked former title challenger in Gilbert Durinho Burns to defeat the number 12 ranked Neil Magny via second round rear naked choke submission. All right, and now we get to the co-main event of the evening in a battle for the undisputed 125-pound UFC flyweight championship and the first ever quadrilogy in UFC history between the reigning, defending, undisputed UFC flyweight champion in Davison De Juste Guerra Figueiredo going up against the interim champion who won the belt with a third round TKO over Kai Kara France in the assassin baby Brandon Moreno. Moreno versus Figueiredo 4, who will come out on top and claim supremacy in the quadrilogy. Look, this is a great fight. I feel like I say that a lot, but I'm not super excited or looking forward to this fight on paper just because we've seen it 3 times. And although it's been 3 different outcomes, I feel like we get the same fight most of the time. There's just little small adjustments that either Figueiredo or Moreno make to make the fight go in their favor. And the first fight was at UFC 256, where the fight ended in a draw. I know a lot of people said that if Figueiredo didn't get that point deduction, he would have won the fight. So technically, Figueiredo was winning the fight, but he got the point deduction due to the groin strikes and then ended up losing. Moreno came on strong in the later rounds, very close early rounds. And then you go into the second fight. Moreno drops Figueiredo with a jab, jumps on him, takes his back, and submits him with a rear naked choke in the second round, and then claims the flyweight championship. He goes into the third fight and defends the title against Figueiredo in the trilogy bout at UFC 270. That fight's completely back and forth, you know. But Figueiredo lands the bigger shots and ends up dropping Moreno twice, once with a left hook and then another time with an overhand right over the jab of Moreno, which obviously swayed the judges to give the decision to Figueiredo, even though a lot of people, including myself at the time that the fight took place, believed that Moreno did enough to win that fight and retain his title. But regardless of what we're saying, Figueiredo wins and becomes the new UFC flyweight champion. And we haven't seen Figueiredo since that fight, which took place in January of 2022. So it's been over a year since we've seen Figueiredo inside the UFC octagon. And when it comes to Moreno, the last time we saw him was at UFC 270. I want to say it was UFC 274. I could be wrong. No, UFC 277, right? Let's see. Yeah, UFC 277, where he got that third round TKO with that left kick to the body against Kai Kara France and finished him off. It was a close competitive fight. I feel like some people thought that Kai Kara France was up 2 rounds and Moreno was winning the third. I feel like some people thought Moreno was up 2-0. you know, going into the third, it was back and forth, either 2-0 Kai Kara, 2-0 Moreno, 1-1. Like, it was back and forth between a lot of people. I thought that Moreno won the first round pretty decisively. I thought Kai Kara France won the second and was on his way to winning the third before the left hook into the same side switch kick to the body ended up, you know, dropping Kai Kara France and giving Moreno the TKO victory. That's the second victory he had over Kai Kara France. The first fight he won via decision, that was back at UFC 245. Look, I think when you look at this fight stylistically, Moreno's been more active. It's only by one fight, but activity does matter. When you look at Figueiredo versus Moreno, Moreno is going to have the better boxing. He's going to have more volume. He's going to have better technical ability with the boxing, but it's going to be the one-hitter quitter shots and the big moments throughout the five rounds that's going to sway the judges, and most likely what swayed the judges to give Figueiredo the decision to give him the title win at UFC 270. And I feel like that's kind of what we're looking at in this fight as well, because you have to go back and look at those other fights when you break down this one and really study how the fights go. Moreno's going to have the speed advantage. He's going to have the volume advantage. He's going to have the technical striking advantage. And we've always said, like, with speed comes power. And I feel like the speed of Moreno's shots gives him more power, and it hurts Figueiredo when he starts landing combinations. Even in the third fight, Figueiredo was getting stunned. He was getting cracked. He was getting hurt. And it's mainly because Figueiredo fights with that hands-down style, kind of like a poor man's version of a Dominic Cruz, but more just based off the hands low, you know, kind of moving his head off to the left. He'll move his head off to the left lead side and feint that rear cross, so then he can slip inside of your jab as you throw it and throw the overhand right, come back with the left hook. He can throw a jab, switch off, get off on an angle, stand in a side stance. He has more of a side stance traditionally, and he'll switch between a side stance and a karate style stance like we saw Henry Cejudo use in his fight against Wilson Hayes. You know, and he trained out at Fight Ready, but he's not at Fight Ready for this camp, I believe. That's something that I've heard, something I've looked at. So you have to look at that as, you know, he's not going to have Cejudo. He's not at Fight Ready. So he's going to be coming in a different fighter. And I feel like if he had Cejudo in this camp, he might do a little bit better in this quadrilogy bout. But, you know, looking at the stylistic matchup between the two, like I said, I think Moreno's going to have the better boxing. He's going to have the better technical advantage when it comes to the hands. Figueiredo's going to have the bigger power, and he's going to probably have the bigger moments throughout the 25 minutes, which is going to mean that Moreno's going to have to be a lot more active throughout the rounds in order to make sure that even if those big moments do occur, that Moreno does enough work prior to those moments to win the rounds on the scorecards, because that could be where the judges were swayed and why the judges gave that fight to Figueiredo, because going into the trilogy bout, going into the scorecards, I had Moreno up 3-2, and I think he should have won it and retained his title, but that's not what happened. So more activity and bigger moments for Moreno, but mainly the volume, more activity, and better defense is going to make those big moments, even if they do occur on the side of Figueiredo, if it's a big right hand, a big left hook, a big jab, you know, knocking Moreno off balance, slipping the jab, coming over the top with the overhand right, that's going to be not enough for Figueiredo to win those rounds. So Moreno has to do more damage, and we know he's capable of it because he dropped Figueiredo in the rematch at UFC 260. When did the second fight between Figueiredo and Moreno take place? Let's see. Was it 263? Yeah, 263. Okay, I was right. UFC 263, and that's where Moreno won with a third round rear naked choke submission. He dropped him with a jab. He was piecing him up on the feet. Figueiredo didn't look himself. And, you know, we saw more of that in the trilogy bout with, like I said, the speed, the boxing combinations, the left hook from Brandon Moreno, the jab from Brandon Moreno, the left switch kick from the orthodox stance, switching into southpaw to land the left kick to the body, like we saw him drop Kai Kara France with in his most recent bout. The left high kick, the lead high kick, the left hook into the same side body kick, left hook into the same side high kick. Everything off the lead side for Moreno is going to be his key to victory, while everything off of the rear side, the right hand of Davison Figueiredo, the overhand right, the straight right hand, the right elbows, the right calf kicks, it's going to be lead versus rear side in this fight. And that's kind of the story of these two when you look at it. I feel like the calf kicks were a big, big weapon for Figueiredo in the trilogy bout with Moreno. And he did the most damage with that, aside from the overhand right and the left hook he was able to land. With Moreno, it's the jab. It's the left hook. It's the hook off the jab. It's the hook into the same side left body kick. It's the jab into the same side left high kick. It's the cross switch kick, or the cross switch stance into the lead left switch kick. Like, that, everything on the lead side is going to win the fight for Moreno. Tying that in with obviously catching Figueiredo's forward pressure with the body lock trips, whether it's an inside or an outside trip. I feel like that's going to be what offsets Figueiredo's momentum and makes him gun shy to land those big shots, which would aid in Figueiredo losing those rounds and Moreno winning them because of the volume that Moreno's going to be outputting throughout the 25-minute bout. I think that this is a very difficult fight to pick. And to be honest, if there's one fight on the entire card that I don't think anybody should bet on, it's Figueiredo versus Moreno. I think it's better to just sit back, watch, and enjoy the high-level fight that we're going to get because these guys are so closely contested. They are so evenly matched overall that I feel like it's better to just stay away from this on all aspects of betting. I see a lot of people taking Moreno. I see a lot of people backing Figueiredo. I think this fight is so close that either guy can win. Either one can walk out as the undisputed champion, so it's better to stay away from it on all aspects. I don't even like over-unders because we've seen Moreno be capable of getting a finish. We've seen Figueiredo drop Moreno with big power shots, even though Moreno showed the durability to last and come back later in the fight. I don't like the over-unders. I don't like the money line. I don't like a winning method. You know, if anything, I would say maybe fight goes to decision because I don't necessarily see a finish happening, but we've seen Moreno finish Figueiredo. We've seen Figueiredo drop Moreno and be able to almost get a finish by hurting him bad with his boxing. So I don't like this fight at all. I think you should stay away from it in all aspects when it comes to betting. If you're looking at betting on the card, I would look at other fights and stay away from the co-main event. I don't like this at all, and I'm not going to bet anything when it comes to this fight. This is one I'm staying away from completely. But breaking down the winner, like I said, man, it's very difficult to pick a winner here, and I don't really know. I'm going to be honest. Like, the pick I'm going to give you here, there's a reason I'm saying not to bet on it. I'm very weary in making a pick, but based off the activity, based off the boxing capability that we've seen Moreno showcase and how much his boxing and hand speed has given Figueiredo trouble, even in the fights that Figueiredo has won, mainly the trilogy bout at 270, and then the draw that they went to in the first fight, the jab, the left hook, the 1-2-3, the jab cross hook, the lead left high kick, the left body kick, those all give Figueiredo a lot of trouble, and it's the variety of weapons and the speed that Moreno possesses versus the one-hitter-quitter power of Davison Figueiredo and the wrestling that Moreno can use, even though I think it's going to be a little bit harder for Moreno to implement those takedowns, whether it's body lock takedowns with inside or outside trips. I'm still going to lean towards Moreno, but the one thing you have to look at is, you know, James Krause, the betting scandal, everything like that. Moreno is now over at Fortis MMA with coach Saif Saud. This will be the first camp he's working with Fortis MMA. So how different of a Moreno are we going to see going into this fight compared to other fights because he's working alongside coach Saif Saud at Fortis? I think it's a good move for Moreno, you know, and stuff like that, but it's something you have to take into consideration because of the James Krause betting scandal, him not being able to coach, him probably, you know, he'll probably end up going to prison based off of this whole entire betting scandal with the Derek Minner, Shylin, Nurdambike fight. So I don't really know. And then on the side of Figueiredo, he's not with Fight Ready anymore. He's not with Fight Ready preparing for this fight. So how much is the absence of Henry Cejudo and coach Eric Albarracin going to play into Figueiredo's side in terms of coaching going into this fight, along with the layoff that Figueiredo has had for over a year since the first fight that took place, or the trilogy fight that took place, and that's the last fight that Figueiredo has had while Moreno had the activity with the Kai Car France win and got the win via finish. I'm going to side with Moreno here, but again, like I said, it's basically like a 52-48, 51-49 in terms of a pick here because they are so closely matched and so closely contested. But I'm going to go with a decision. I don't see a finish here. I think that Figueiredo will be able to last, but I'm going to go with a 48-47 unanimous decision victory for Brandon Moreno to become the new UFC flyweight champion, the undisputed UFC flyweight champion, and go up 2-1 against Figueiredo in the quadrilogy bout. If you're picking Figueiredo, I'm not upset with you. If you think his power, his variety, his awkward movement and footwork and stance changes is going to be more than enough to beat Moreno, that's fine. I'm not, like I said, I'm not going to discredit anybody for either side that they take in this fight, but I'm going to go with Moreno. Originally, I was on Figueiredo, but the more I thought about it and everything going into it, I'm going to go with Moreno here. 48-47 unanimous decision for Brandon the Assassin Baby Moreno to become the new UFC flyweight champion in this fight and win the quadrilogy bout. But when it comes to an overall pick or like betting stance, stay away from the fight in terms of betting all around. And now it's time for the main event of the evening for the vacant UFC light heavyweight championship in a battle between the former light heavyweight champion and the number two ranked Glover Teixeira, who comes into the bout with a record of 33 victories and 8 defeats, going up against the number seven ranked Jamal Sweet Dreams Hill, who comes back with a record of 11 victories with 1 lone defeat, which actually comes at the hands of the man who opens up the main card in Paul Bearjew Craig, who was able to submit him, which we already talked about earlier. But Teixeira versus Hill for the vacant UFC light heavyweight championship. Who walks out of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, as the new king atop the throne at 205 pounds? Man, this is a really, really solid fight. I'm excited to break it down. This is a main event that going into the card breakdown, I wasn't super excited for. But the more I broke down the tape and the more I studied both fighters, this is going to be a very interesting fight until it's over. And it could end in the blink of an eye on either side. That's really what I believe. You look at overall, we'll look at the stats real quick because for the main event, I think we should look at the tail of the tape. Teixeira coming off the title loss to Jiří Procházka at UFC 275. He was probably going to win the fight via decision in the fifth round. You know, he got submitted with a rear naked choke by Jiří Procházka and lost his title. Jiří got injured. He was supposed to go and fight Glover at UFC 282. He had to pull out. He'll probably be out for close to a year. Then Magomed Ankalaev went and fought Jan Blachowicz for the vacant title at UFC 282. That fight ended in a draw. So now at 283, we're going to get the reigning defending rightful champion at 205 pounds. You know, and with the John Jones announcement and him going up to heavyweight, returning at UFC 285 to take on Ciryl Gane, I mean, this is a very interesting fight, and I feel like the announcement of John Jones at heavyweight makes this fight have more eyes to see who's going to carry on the light heavyweight division until Jiří Procházka makes his return. But, you know, Teixeira's coming off that loss to Jiří. Jamal Hill is coming off of that late fourth round TKO over Thiago Santos in a back-and-forth fight. You know, Thiago was able to take him down, use his wrestling, get the takedowns. But even when Jamal Hill gets taken down, he really never settles for position. He's always trying to push down on the head, you know, shrimp his hips and work his way back up to the feet, whether he's in the middle of the cage or he'll work his way with his back to the fence and try to use the fence to get up, use that wall walk and get up game to try to get up. He never really settles for position. Even when he's tired, he's always trying to work his way back up to his feet, even when he does get taken down. But he has been susceptible to wrestling and takedowns in his UFC career. Looking at the height, it's a 2-inch height advantage for Sweet Dreams Jamal Hill, or Jamal Sweet Dreams Hill. He's got a 6'4", he's 6'4", and Glover Teixeira is 6'2". On the side of the reach, it's a 3-inch reach advantage, so 2-inch height advantage. 3-inch reach advantage for Jamal Hill. And with the way Jamal Hill fights out of that southpaw stance with that boxing heavy approach, you know, he's very good with his range, very good with his distance. A lot of the times when it comes to his defense, he'll use a lot of like catching off the shoulder, down blocking, parrying. His defense isn't the greatest, but he's very effective with it. It doesn't look pretty, but it works. And he's very good at pulling, you know, pulling back, using a pull game to pull away from shots and come back on counters. His best shot is definitely the check right hook. And going up against the orthodox fighter in Glover Teixeira, that's something he's going to be looking for. The battle of the outside foot with orthodox versus southpaw is going to be of utmost importance in this fight when it comes to the striking on the feet. Jamal Hill is going to constantly be looking to land that check right hook. And a lot of the times when people use a check hook, it doesn't really have the power to knock people out. But Jamal Hill has sat a lot of people down with that hook. He's hurt people with that hook. You go and look at the fight against Jimmy Crute. Right in the beginning of the fight, he landed a check hook behind the ear. and dropped Jimmy Crute. And then Jimmy Crute came in to try to land a jab and boom, got caught with the check right hook, dropped and finished. So he has power. He uses it to get that outside foot. He uses it to keep his distance and work his angles. But it's also got power to knock you out. And that's something that Glover has to be worried about. Even though he is durable, you know, he does get hit a lot. And I feel like that check hook, even when Glover tries to close the distance, can put Glover Teixeira out cold. Glover Teixeira has good boxing. He's got good bob and weave style, a really good like Mike Tyson-esque style of head movement and boxing, traditional boxing approach, you know, slip, slip, roll, bob and weave, come back with the 1-2, the right hand, the left hook to the body, the jab, left hook to the body. His boxing is very clean and technical, and his defense looks good, but the one thing I've noticed with Glover is once he starts to get hit, he's not very good at adjusting his defense and using that defense to counter. Yes, he can land it every once in a while, but his overall fundamental defense isn't the greatest, and he does get hit a lot. But he has decent counters. I guess I kind of contradicted myself. But what I'm trying to say and what I was trying to say is that Glover Teixeira has good counter ability, but his fundamental defense isn't the best, which I feel like can leave him to a lot of openings with Jamahal Hill on the feet. But in the same token, Glover Teixeira's takedown ability, his wrestling, his top game, his work from the mount, the half guard, the back mount, his submission game, his jiu-jitsu, it's all world class. And if Jamahal Hill gets taken down, even though he doesn't really settle for position and he has good takedown defense and the ability to work back up to his feet if he does get taken down, the last place you want to be in this fight if you're Jamahal Hill is on your back or with Glover Teixeira on top of you on the ground. Because the minute that Glover Teixeira is on top of Jamahal Hill, it's a wrap, son. Like, I feel like he might be able to get up from one or two takedowns and work his way back up to the feet. But for the most part, once Glover gets Jamahal Hill to the ground, like, that's going to be it. You know, he's going to be able to submit him. He's going to be able to ground and pound him. And Jamahal Hill will be open for submissions. You look at the statistics in the fight. And let me go to the significant strikes. Glover Teixeira lands 3.8 significant strikes per minute while Jamahal Hill lands. He doubles him up basically at 6.46 significant strikes per minute, almost doubling the amount that Teixeira lands. He also has a higher accuracy rate. So with almost 7 significant strikes landed per minute, he lands at a 52% accuracy. Basically, if he throws 4 punches, 2 of them are landing, you know, most of the time. And then you look at strikes absorbed per minute, it's pretty close, but Glover does take more damage. Like we said, he has kind of a liability in terms of defense when it comes to strikes and multiple shot combinations from his opponent. 3.93 strikes landed or strikes significant strikes absorbed per minute and 3.51 significant strikes absorbed per minute for Jamahal Hill. Both of these guys aren't the greatest defensively, but I feel like when it comes to the boxing, when it comes to the striking, I think Jamahal Hill's a little bit better defensively, while Glover is better technically in terms of mixing up the game all around. But I don't think Glover wants to play around on the feet with Jamahal Hill too much, because his best path to victory, like we said, is the wrestling, jiu-jitsu, and the takedown game. When it comes to overall striking defense, like I said, 45% striking defense rate for Jamahal Hill, 52% striking defense for Glover Teixeira. So statistically, Teixeira is better, but he does absorb more strikes, you know, and kind of is a liability defensively. Looking at the grappling, this is where it's going to be on the side of Glover Teixeira. He lands 2.2 takedowns per 15-minute fight with a 37% takedown accuracy rate. Even though Glover has a 60% takedown defense, what you really want to look out for is the 65% takedown defense rate of Jamahal Hill. You know, basically going 60-40. You know, if you shoot 10 takedowns, you're going to get 6 of them on Jamahal Hill is basically what this is saying. You know, you're going to get 6 or 7 out of 10 takedowns if you shoot them. And he got taken down 6 times by Thiago Santos, got taken down early in his career as well. And that's something you definitely have to be careful of. But like I said, that's something that I think a lot of people breaking this fight down may be overanalyzing to the point where, yes, Glover Teixeira can take down Jamahal Hill, but Jamahal Hill's get-up game is very good and he doesn't settle for positions. Even if he does get taken down, you know, even when Thiago Santos took him down 6 times in their fight, I believe it was 6 times, he still found a way to push down on the head, you know, work his way up to the fence, use the over-under game, you know, work his way back off the fence to the center, push down on the head and shrimp his hips to work his way back up. Like, he doesn't settle. He's very busy even if he does get taken down. But against Glover, who's going to be a much better grappler than Thiago Santos, and we saw that in the fight between Thiago Santos and Glover Teixeira, where once it got to the ground, you know, Thiago was kind of a fish out of water, and Thiago was able to use his wrestling and takedowns to control Jamal Hill for the majority of the success that he had in that fight. Like I said, the ground is not a place that Jamal Hill wants to be. I think that this fight can end very quickly on either side. Jamal Hill can catch Glover Teixeira coming in with the check right hook, drop him and knock him out. We've seen Glover Teixeira get dropped. We've seen him get pieced up. We've seen him get hit multiple times and find a way to come back. And to be honest, the first round is very scary for me if you're on the Glover Teixeira side, because one check right hook from Jamal Hill can knock out Glover Teixeira. You know, he is durable. He is a veteran. He's a dog, but he has been dropped. He has been hurt in most of his fights. And, you know, he can come back and he can use his wrestling to, you know, negate the striking offense from his opponent and then drag the opponent into the world that he wants to be in. We've seen he has good striking. Like I said, very good left hook, one of the best left hooks in the game. Dropped Anthony Smith with it multiple times, hurt Jan Blachowicz in his title-winning performance at UFC 267. That's what led up to the finish. But I really think that Glover's going to have his way with Jamal Hill on the floor. It worries me in the first round, but going into the second, I think Glover's going to be able to close that distance. He's going to push Jamal Hill up against the cage. He's going to get those takedowns. He's going to take the back of Jamal Hill, flatten him out, ground and pound him, and lock up a submission. I have to go Glover Teixeira by submission here. Jamal Hill has a lot of power. He's one of the best boxers in the light heavyweight division. Overall striking, there's definitely better strikers, but boxing fundamentals, you know, his ability to use the check right hook to keep the outside foot, it is going to be very difficult for Teixeira to close the distance and get into the range that he wants to be in, which is the takedowns, the clinch range, the takedown range, pushing Jamal Hill up against the cage. But Glover's tenacity and his ability to get through the fire is what's going to carry me to pick him to regain his title here in this fight. I think that Jamal Hill will catch him. I think he will hurt him, but Glover will survive and he'll be able to come back, get the takedown, get the back of Jamal Hill, flatten him out, punch him a little bit. Jamal will give up his neck and Teixeira is going to get the submission. So my overall pick for the main event of UFC 283 is and new Glover Teixeira, the number 2 ranked light heavyweight, to regain his title in his home country of Brazil, become the new UFC light heavyweight champion with a second round rear naked choke submission over Jamal Hill, handing him not only his second career loss, but his second career loss by submission, because we've already talked about the Paul Craig loss, the only lone loss on his record already. But I'm going to side with the veteran. I'm going to side with the dog and Glover Teixeira to get the win via second round submission. I just think the grappling deficiencies of Jamal Hill, the takedown defense inconsistencies, and just the inexperience he has on the floor, that makes Glover Teixeira a nightmare for him. So I'm going to go with Glover Teixeira to become the new UFC light heavyweight champion via second round rear naked choke submission. All right, that's going to be it for my breakdown, predictions, and analysis for UFC 283, which takes place this upcoming Saturday from the Juness Arena in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. This podcast will be broken down into individual segments for each fight and uploaded to my YouTube channel, which is the same name as the podcast, at Touch 'Em Up Podcast. You can also check me out on the audio podcast, which is what you're listening to right now. You know, you can leave a review for this podcast on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else that reviews are permitted. That always helps us grow. You can donate to the podcast or the YouTube channel via PayPal. I'll leave the link in the description to the podcast along with the link in the description of the YouTube videos if that's where you have found me. But I'm your host, Double M, and I'm out. Have a good night, everybody, and enjoy the fights this weekend.